When a Russian-U.S. summit will be held in Switzerland, usually when these types of meetings are held between countries, there's hope of closer and better relations, but that does not seem to be the case with these two countries, whose relations have been on a downward path for a while now and have even accelerated in its decline with the election of Joe Biden as U.S. president. Stay with us as we take a look at what the summit could bring and what it all could mean on this debate. I'd like to start this crossing over to Washington, D.C., welcoming Colin Campbell. Colin, thanks so much for being with us. Well, tell us what's being said about this summit from that side of the world.
Right now, Marcia, as you know, the rating between the relationship between the U.S. and Russia is believed to be one of the worst it has been in years. And especially when you have the American president that is visiting right now in Cornwall for the G7, where Russia has been excluded from what used to be the G8, you can tell that there is some tension between Russia and the U.S. Well, with the upcoming meeting between U.S. President Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, there's expected to be a myriad of issues that they will be addressing. One of the big things is cybersecurity, where there were reported to be a number of breaches on behalf of the Russians into U.S. agencies and U.S. banking systems and the U.S. cyberstructure in general. And of course, you have the annexation of Crimea, which has been a long sore subject for the U.S. and U.S. officials. And then you have other issues like climate change. One thing that we have to remember is right now, with this president, with Joe Biden, the U.S., or at least the Biden administration at the very least, is viewing Russia, including China, as a threat, as an adversary, which is much different than the tone that the previous president had with Vladimir Putin, where there seemed to be some type of camaraderie. Some have even described it as a romance between brothers. This is not going to be the case with Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin, where the relationship already seems to be adversarial. So there are going to be a myriad issues. They're going to have to get past their relationship difficulties and then see how both countries could move forward with some type of amenable relationship.
Thanks so much for that update. That's Press TV's Colin Campbell out of Washington, D.C. And now I'd like to welcome our guests out of New York, Don DeBoer, radio host, journalist, and political activist. Don, great to see you. Don, do you think that this upcoming summit will be as tumultuous as the China-U.S. talks, which we saw earlier this year?
Well, it's a good thing to reference the way the United States' policy is tilted some vis-a-vis China in the context of looking at relations with Russia. 50 years ago, when Kissinger goes to China and Nixon goes to China, and you essentially have a breaking up of the socialist bloc into a three-headed monster in the world with the United States and the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China as three points on a triangle, instead of having a trilateral relationship with the United States pitting one against the other. U.S. policy since December of 1991, and you remember that Hillary Clinton said Christmas in the Kremlin, it's kind of like Christmas 1991. The Soviet Union falls, and U.S. policy, rather than acknowledging that, we always wanted them to have a capitalist economic system and to be willing to take, let us buy chunks of their industry and all this stuff, that they would have accepted victory and that's it. But instead, the U.S. kept moving its military resources right up to, in essence, occupying some of the same territory that Hitler occupied in Operation Barbarossa. The Baltic republics are now part of NATO. Ukraine is, for all practical purposes, part of NATO. The entire Warsaw Pact, I believe, is part of NATO. And so the strategic position towards the former Soviet Union, towards Russia, has actually been more aggressive on a steady pace since 1991. China also has seen a U.S. aggressive posture, particularly from the period of the Obama administration with the whole roiling over the South China Sea, some very aggressive naval maneuvering that goes on there on a regular basis, provocative patrols, also the insertion of THAAD missiles into Korea. Just now, as a matter of fact, Biden telling the Republic of Korea, in other words, South Korea, it's okay if you build your own missiles that can reach Beijing. Now, the message being received in both Beijing and Moscow is, in essence, the U.S. is an existential threat. We saw in 2014, after the coup in Ukraine, that the response was then they stood up and declared that they have a strategic partnership, which is the exact undoing, almost the antithesis, of what they were trying to achieve in the late 60s and actually had achieved to the benefit of the United States. So it's hard to understand what the strategy is other than it looking like they're going to go to war with both of them, which is insane.
Well, stay with me, Don, because I want to look at that a little bit later. But let me get our next guests in on this discussion, Bill Jones out of Leesburg from the Executive Intelligence Review. Thanks so much for being with us, Bill. Now, as Don just talking about the increased antagonism between the U.S. and Russia, also the U.S. and China, why do you think that is the case? Why has Washington chosen to go in that direction?
Well, in principle, it's the fact that the international system as we have known it since the collapse of the Soviet Union, with the United States being the rule maker, is at an end. It's falling apart financially, economically, and in every possible way. What has happened over the last decade is that, of course, Russia, which was more or less on its last legs by the beginning of the 1990s, as I think the speaker might have mentioned, came back under President Putin. China had this remarkably dramatic development, which it has now become the second most important economic power in the world, and probably the motor, the real engine of economic development at this point. The United States, through its own mistakes, through its own negligence, through its own neglect, let its economy really go to hell in a handbasket. The big profits were in the developing countries, where you paid a dollar a day for workers, so that our industries were left adrift. Our workers were sent from factories, high-tech factories, to McDonald's, and the U.S. economy was in very sad shape, and it's only the power of the dollar which gave an indication that that it was still on top of the game. But with the rise of China, this suddenly changed. The Belt and Road Initiative changed the geometry for the developing world in Africa, Asia, Latin America. All these countries were going to hell in a handbasket as a result of Western financial policy and total neglect. With the BRI, they started moving forward. So instead of reacting positively to this, looking at what's going on and saying, hey, we better put our game together and try and invest and do the kind of things that China is doing that we used to do, instead, they have said they are going to undermine this program and to try and reassert the world as it was 10 years before.
Okay.
The G7 meeting was an example of that, but I think it is doomed to failure.
Well, Don, I mean, both you and Bill have now talked about the direction that the United States could have gone and should have gone, but chose to go in a more antagonistic way. Going back to 1991, of course, the breakup of the Soviet Union, and we saw this rise in that capitalist perspective taking place in the former Soviet Union, in Russia. And you mentioned that. Why do you think that the United States was not satisfied with that, saying, okay, that we've won, the capitalist perspective in this case has won, and worked together as allies, but instead, as you mentioned, we saw a lot more aggression as far as NATO and taking over or controlling some of those former Soviet states. Why do you think that Washington took that path?
Clearly, the interests of a very small group of people who have control of the levers of power in the West, it's, you know, not a question really, it's a statement of fact, their policy was not intended to bring capitalism and democracy to the people of Russia after thwart the quote-unquote Red Menace. Rather, it was to protect their own interests from, you know, a spread, basically, of socialist ideas and economics, and particularly the forward movement of their own greed, basically, that not only do we want capitalist relations in Russia, we want to own everything ourselves. Me, I want it. I don't want them to have it that way. I want it. And the positioning of U.S. forces is intended to do exactly that. The demands that are made on Russia, for example, have nothing to do with any restoration of socialism in the country, although the undoing of some of the looting that went on by some Western interests certainly roiled a few feathers here. But more importantly, what's been happening is the people here that make the decisions have been looking at the geostrategic position vis-a-vis Russia constantly and pursuing, you know, an adverse relationship in that area since 1991, even more aggressively. It was enough when they had Boris Yeltsin in there pretty much as an affable puppet when he wasn't blowing up the parliament. But even then, when there was just a thwarting of the continued looting of the country and an ultimate takeover of Rosneft and the other petrochemical and oil industries by Western corporations, when they were thwarted in that, they started turning up the heat, and instead of pretending to be nice while they moved the army and the tanks and stuff into position at the borders, they started getting nasty. Finally, when Donald Trump got elected and started questioning that entire paradigm, started saying, well, you know, we don't have to be belligerent towards Russia, and, you know, we don't need NATO, this military monster anymore that costs us so much money because the Soviet Union is gone and its purpose was to protect us from that. The reason that he became the heretic that the intel agencies, the media, and the entire power elite in both parties turned on him was over exactly that question. There are some very powerful people that think that the wealth of Russia and its people belongs to them. They have the largest military in the history of the world that's been working on that project since 1917, really, and in China since 1949, and they're trying to achieve it. They're trying to actualize this, and they're risking world war over it.
Hmm. What about that bill? Are we talking about the 1%, the elitists, doing all of this just for their own sake? As Don has just said, even risking war and costing people across the world and even the Americans themselves a whole lot of money and increasing tension for basically what they would see as a profit for a few.
Well, the question facing the United States is it prepared to work together with other major powers, and I include among these major powers Russia and China, to try and rebuild a financial and world economic system that works for the people's benefits. What China has shown is that the world can move in a different direction. They can move to eliminate poverty. They can move to begin a program of rapid development, even in the most desolated countries in Africa and Asia, to try and bring them up to a modern standard. And the technical means are there now. They've been there for a long time. And now the political will has been shown by China in moving in that direction. But is the United States willing to work with China on this? Or is it prepared to maintain and to reassert, I should say, its hegemony by undermining China's economic development? Right now, it seems that they're moving in that direction, although I think there's a little bit of doubt as to whether they're going to accomplish this, given some of the statements coming out from the White House just recently, both with regard to Russia and with regard to the discussions with China. But if they moved in that direction, this would become an existential threat for both China and Russia. And since it would be an existential threat to undermine their own economic development, I think that that could very easily lead to war, as the other speaker clearly indicated. I think, however, that if this goes too far, where it shows that the tensions are going to reach a breaking point, I think the present administration will have to change tack and move in a direction of trying to find a means of working together with these so-called rivals in order to deal with some of the fundamental questions facing the world, like the economic crisis, like the financial blowout that we're facing today. But it's anybody's guess that they will be wise enough to do that, and the present direction that it's taking is a very, very dangerous direction.
Well, Don, what about that? You heard what Bill said. Do you see the United States changing direction and being able to work with Russia, with China? Or do you anticipate this continual decline in relations between Washington, Beijing, and Moscow?
You know, first of all, I hope he's right. The last part of Bill's statement that they're going to be forced to change course. The problem is that the very essence of their behavior rests on an irrational set of conditions. And by that I mean in terms of economics. I had a conversation with the guy who was the acting head of the Export-Import Bank a couple of years ago down in Washington on this particular point. And that is, the United States has, the world has, say, 7 billion people or whatever it is, and somewhere between a third to a half of them are challenged or lack completely water, sewage, housing, hospitals, electrical grid, all kinds of infrastructure, schools, et cetera, on the one hand. On the other hand, in the United States alone, the ability to build hospitals, schools, housing, et cetera, all these things, we have the expertise to do it. We have the equipment sitting on lots, rusting, in essence, masons and carpenters and all of that. And for some reason, the irrationality, the essential irrationality of the economic system here does not make it profitable, does not make it, successful. It can't really actualize applying these resources to those problems which they were designed to solve. On the other hand, China can go from place to place in the world and say, want this or you want that, and they can build canals, we can build deep water ports, we can build transcontinental railroads, we can put your satellites up in the air. Oh, and by the way, we can build you a city if you want one. And for some reason, their accounting system makes that a profitable endeavor for them, and ours makes it an unprofitable, a prohibitively unprofitable endeavor. To me, it seems like someone's got to take the accounting system, which means essentially the way the property, the wealth is allocated in the United States, and shake it like you would with an upside-down etch-a-sketch into a reset position so that the productive capacity of this country can be applied to solving the production needs of half of the population of the world. This is a condition where we are, this irrational thing, was predicted by Marx and Engels, 150 years ago. But it is naked now in front of the world, but particularly when you consider the mass of needs that exist and the mass of productive capacity that is sitting wasted, the workers watching television, smoking pot, and the equipment rusting in the driveway.
Well, I mean, it really does seem sad that the potential is there. As you had said, almost half of the people in the world basically are lacking basic necessities, clean water, clean food. But has that been a goal of the United States? Do you see that being a goal of the United States? Do you see a transition that Washington could make, Bill, and trying to work with others to make that a reality? I mean, is that a goal? Is it a priority for them?
Well, I didn't quite get your question. It started to break up a little bit, but I think I did get the gist of it. There are a number of things that stand in the way of them trying to reassert the so-called G7, control of the world. One are the differences within G7? You see that in the different attitudes that have been taken, which you can judge from also some of the press reports that have already come out, that all of the countries are not as intent on confronting China in the way that the Biden administration wants them to. So you've got the dissent there. There's not unity on this issue, nor do I think there is unity among seven that we should go back to a world in which the United States alone is calling the shots. So they got that problem there. The second thing is...
Yeah, I'm sorry, Bill, because we're having a little audio issue there. Let me cross over. Let me cross over to Don. Don, your assessment of possibilities with this upcoming summit, your expectations?
You're talking about the summit with Putin, with Rutland, right?
Right.
Well, first of all, it's noteworthy that the very next meeting that Biden has after the G7, from which Russia has been excluded, will be NATO, of which Russia is a target. So it seems to me that what he's doing is taking an assessment of his forces first, Biden or whoever programs his teleprompter more accurately. And then they are going to push him and the team into the room to negotiate if anything is really actually going to be discussed at this summit, which is another question. You know, one of the things that people don't realize is most of the work that's done for these, summits, the summit is more or less a TV show. The actual work is done by functionaries on both sides that, understand tact policy and military policy and how weapons work and how sea lanes work and all of that stuff. Well, these guys have lunch and coffee or whatever. Whatever is going on, it seems
30 seconds, Don. 30 seconds. Go ahead.
It seems that an aggressive posture, scene is being set for an aggressive posture, including in the media here, by the way, who you remember scoriated Trump, called him a traitor for not being belligerent in Helsinki in 2018.
All right. And on that note, appreciate both of you being with us from the Executive Intelligence Review, Bill Jones out of Leesburg, and radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Sarah.
And the eminent among his people who disbelieved and denied the meeting of the hereafter, while we had given them luxury in the worldly life, said, "This is not but a man like yourselves. He eats of that from which you eat, and drinks of what you drink."
Dear listeners, in the second section of this chapter, starting from about verse number 23, the Almighty Allah explained about the prophet Noah and how this prophet was saved and some of his people. Now in this section, starting from verse number 33, the Holy Quran explains about the generations raised after Noah's people. وَقَالَ الْمَلَأُ مِنْ قَوْمِهِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا وَكَذَّبُوا بِلِقَاءِ الْآخِرَةِ وَأَتْرَفْنَاهُمْ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا مَا هَذَا إِلَّا بَشَرٌ مِئْثْلُكُمْ يَأْكُلُ مِمَّا تَأْكُلُونَ مِنْهِ وَيَشْرَبُ مِمَّا تَشْرَبُ. The chiefs of his people who disbelieved and denied the meeting of hereafter, and whom we had given affluence in the life of the world, said, "This is nothing but a mortal like you, and he eats of what you eat from, and drinks of what you drink." You may remember that in the previous program, the verses under discussion talked about the generation that was produced after the generation of Noah. And the Almighty Allah said that we sent among those people a messenger from among themselves. And he invited people to monotheism. And he called unto the people and he told them, "Why would you not keep from evil?" أَفَلَا تَتَّقُونَ. And in this verse, this is what actually answered. But what is important is that the call of the divine prophets was based upon liberating people from the dominance and cruelty of those oppressors and those cruel rulers. And consequently, the aristocrats opposed the prophets more than the others did. We also had it earlier in the previous verses, وَقَالَ الْمَلَأُ مِنْ قَوْمِهِ, that are the chiefs of his people. About Prophet Noah, the chiefs from among the disbelievers denied him. And now about this prophet, which is probably Prophet Salih, the chiefs of his people who disbelieved and denied the meeting of hereafter said that this is nothing but a mortal like you. So the Holy Quran in this holy verse implies that the affluent and conceited folk upon whom Allah has bestowed abundant blessings are the ones who negated the one God, Allah, and denied the meeting of resurrection. They said, "This is only a mortal like you. He eats what you eat and he drinks what you drink, and he's just a normal being. He cannot be a prophet."
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Oh.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
The verse says, وَقَالَ الْمَلَأُ مِنْ قَوْمِهِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا وَكَذَّبُوا بِلِقَاءِ الْآخِرَةِ The chiefs of his people who disbelieved and denied the meeting of hereafter, وَأَتَرَفْنَاهُمْ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا And whom we had given affluence in the life of the world, مَا هَذَا إِلَّا بَشَرٌ مِثْلُكُمْ This is nothing but a mortal like you. يَأْكُلُ مِمَّا تَأْكُلُونَ مِنْهُ وَيَشْرَبُ مِمَّا تَشْرَبُونَ He eats of what you eat from, and drinks of what you drink. Yes, the Quran calls those affluent people mala. This means that they were very attractive in their appearance, but their hearts were darkened to the light of truth. They started to struggle against the teachings of their prophet. They started applying the same type of arguments that those people who rejected Noah had done. This they did because they saw the call of this great prophet as going against their desires. They saw the teaching of the prophet as a barrier to their unlawful interests and their baseless social preeminence. It was because of the same affluence that they had been aloof from Allah and denied resurrection. They disputed against the truth with the same logic that the disbelievers of the people of Noah did. The very human nature of these divine leaders, the normal ways in which they ate, drank, and the simple ways in which they lived their lives, this was the fact that was used as reason to negate their prophetic missions. The humanness of these great men, in fact, confirmed their missions because it made them more accessible and more sympathetic to the sufferings of the common people. But this attractive point and positive aspect of the prophets was turned into a negative aspect in view and the eyes of the people by the al-mala'u min qawmi, by the chiefs from among the disbelievers. And these are the ones about whom Imam Ali alayhi salam says, their jealousy made them say such words. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me. Why ends when faith begins?
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters. Two Iranian naval vessels are sailing across the South Atlantic Ocean in southwest of the African continent. The two warships have sailed for up to 12,000 kilometers over a course of a month now and are bound for North Atlantic. Deputy Coordinator for Iran's Army, Rear Admiral Habibullah Sayari, made the announcement on Thursday, saying this is the farthest point that an Iranian warship has ever sailed to.
For the first time, our Navy is sailing such a longest route. Over the past days, our ships have passed by Cape of Good Hope, rounded Africa, and now that are sailing at this point, they will sail on to reach North Atlantic.
The mission is carried out using two domestically built vessels, Sahand Frigate and Macron Floating Base. Fitted with a large helicopter pad, Macron was formerly used as an oil tanker. Sahand Frigate is a radar evading vessel that's equipped with torpedo launchers and electronic warfare technologies. The long journey comes as U.S. officials have claimed that Iran's Navy cannot operate in, quote, blue water. By blue water navies, the U.S. military means the ones that are capable of sailing in open ocean at great distances from their home countries and can operate for extended periods.
When we announced that we would sail in the Atlantic Ocean, some countries said that Iran does not possess such a capability. But today, the Iranian army displayed its naval might by dispatching the 77th Squadron to remote waters using its own fully indigenous vessels.
In 2008, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, hailed the Iranian army's navy as a strategic force. The navy then defined new roles and missions for itself. Among them was to expand its presence in the high seas and remote waters, advance maritime diplomacy, and ensure the safety of Iranian trade vessels by maintaining its presence in the Gulf of Aden. This is the first time Iran's naval ships have set sail this far in open seas. Iranian officials say this is a turning point for the country's naval force, which will help ensure safer maritime trade around the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It's been called the Sausage War, a dispute between the EU and former member UK about chilled meats, among other things, entering the bloc through Northern Ireland. The Brexit divorce deal signed by Prime Minister Boris Johnson kept Northern Ireland in the single market while it withdrew the rest of the UK. To avoid major disruptions caused by a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and potentially jeopardizing the Good Friday Agreement, the two sides negotiated the Northern Ireland Protocol, creating the Irish Sea border. At the time, Prime Minister Boris Johnson described it an excellent deal.
So Boris Johnson lied. What compounds this disaster more than any of the other disasters emanating from Brexit is the fact that we're talking about the resurgence possibly of conflict in that part of the world. 30 years troubles ending with the Good Friday Agreement in 1998. And that agreement is now imperiled.
The Northern Ireland Protocol allows checks to be done between Britain and Northern Ireland instead. That means British food products such as meat and milk arriving in Northern Ireland go through border checks to ensure they meet EU standards. But the new system got off to a shaky start. In early February, the EU complained that some goods were entering Northern Ireland without being checked properly. In March, the UK decided to unilaterally extend the six-month grace period on British chilled meats, sausages included, until October. That angered Brussels, who said the extension broke international law and threatened legal action.
Because they understand that, that this will be playing well for Boris Johnson politically in his Brexit heartlands, so they need to make sure that people know in Britain that they are negotiating in good faith and they're doing their best to make this work. They're willing to go to the nth degree to do so, and they think probably that will highlight how Boris Johnson is not playing. He's not playing an honest hand here.
The UK's Brexit minister, Lord Frost, and his EU peer, Maro Sefcovic, are meeting in London on June 9th to discuss the implementation of the Northern Ireland Protocol, with the EU side saying the Commission would not tolerate further failures of compliance by London.
The UK say that the EU is being too strict about implementing the deal, that Europe is hardly going to be flooded with meat through Northern Ireland. The EU, on the other hand, say they're trying to be helpful, but if Boris Johnson doesn't like the deal, he shouldn't have signed it. Said Bouriza, London.
Pakistan has announced a $55 billion US annual budget The country's opposition parties attempted to block the proceeding of the budget, calling it an IMF-dictated budget and burden on the poor people.
We have come up with budget which would focus on the welfare of every segment of the society. From 1st July, all government employees would be provided 10% ad hoc increase in their salaries.
However, no one among these protesters outside the parliament in the federal capital were willing to trust the government, which linked a controversial bailout package with the IMF about 3 years ago. Under IMF pressure, Pakistan significantly devalued its currency, raised interest rate, and increased tax rates, which led to massive price hike, inflation, and brought down the growth rate.
The government is scared of IMF, and the government and its ministers are helpless. They had agreement with us to provide us our due share in the budget, but they are coming up with a budget which will hit hard the poor people.
Just few months back, the protesters forced the ruling party to ink an agreement with them to provide substantial increase to hundreds of thousands of the government employees. However, now they feel betrayed after government only provided them of what they called an insignificant raise in their salaries. Few weeks ago, Prime Minister Imran Khan sacked his finance minister for towing IMF agenda. Nonetheless, the economic problems are far from over. Pakistan's economy begins to recover with more revenue and more remittances. However, the government is failing to provide relief to the common people suffering from rising unemployment and extraordinary surge in their utility bills. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hampered India's ambition of double-digit growth by 2022. In its latest report, the World Bank has slashed the country's growth forecast to 8.3% from 10.1% estimated earlier. The service sector is the hardest hit, the report added, stressing on higher spending on infrastructure, rural development and healthcare. The ongoing economic turmoil sparked by COVID pandemic has dragged millions in poverty and unemployment.
The damage was already done with the COVID first wave, but whatever was left, second wave devastated it further. It is very hard to find work these days because there is less activity in construction sector.
In recent weeks, the government announced a set of policies related to spending after a pandemic deteriorated the economic prospectus. The central bank also announced measures for micro, small and medium businesses. Over the last few months, India has been struggling with a ferocious second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic with around 400,000 daily cases and thousands of deaths. Hospitals were reeling under shortage of space, oxygen, beds and vaccines. This prompted the government to announce more stringent lockdowns, which resulted in huge economic costs for the world's second most populous nation, where millions rely on daily wages. Migrant workers were the hardest hit.
No matter what it is, the poor people are the ones who struggle most. Rich people have savings, they can survive. But what about us? The second wave has finished everything we had. If these lockdowns continue, we will die.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism over handling COVID crisis. The pandemic with economic slowdown has devastated the livelihood of millions in India. The country is also staring at unemployment crisis, with youth being the worst affected. Observers say to counter slowing economy and unemployment crisis, India needs to launch more stimulus packages and job support schemes the way other developed nations did after COVID ravaged their economies. But fear of third wave in India is creating further doubts if the country is ready to deal with another looming situation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi. As EU leaders continue to try and grapple with COVID-19, hundreds of visitor hotspots across the bloc are more like ghost towns due to ongoing travel restrictions. The European Parliament has approved the EU Digital Travel Certificate. It is supposed to be operational by the 1st of July. 7 EU nations are already using it, but some countries say they won't until the middle of July.
The patchwork is still here, the spaghetti of rules and regulations. Dear national governments, it is in your hands to make sure that people can travel freely.
The new travel cert will show if someone has been vaccinated, recovered from COVID-19, or has had a negative test. A large cohort of EU lawmakers are furious. The tests will not be free. They claim it is a mechanism to effectively force citizens to get vaccinated.
People struggling financially who don't want or don't have access to the jab will not be able to travel, legislators point out. Tests could also be very costly for cross-border workers. This is all very discriminatory, legislators say.
Free movement of people within the 27-nation EU is supposed to be a fundamental right. The lack of travel is having a devastating economic impact.
Uncertainties remain, as the near-term economic outlook continues to depend on the course of the pandemic and how the economy responds after reopening.
Official data shows the youth unemployment rate in the EU is double that of the general population, and that might be an underestimation.
I think it's definitely hard, especially if you start working after studying. I had a lot of friends, even with a good diploma, that had some problems in finding a job, like my brother, for example.
The job market is not very high, actually, so, yeah, I mean, COVID, of course, increases this situation, but we are scared anyway.
The EU travel certificate is being hailed as a tool to jumpstart the bloc's economy, but many lawmakers have data protection concerns.
This crisis is being misused in order to get unpopular things through the back door. These doors should remain shut. The certificate should in no way be used to assert control.
Amid growing fears over people's jobs, the European Central Bank has again appealed to EU leaders not to dither over the deployment of COVID-19 recovery funding. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli forces have shot dead some Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid in the city of Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin to carry out an arrest operation, according to the Israeli military. Outside the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority's military intelligence, a shootout erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian security forces. During the operation, Israeli forces killed Jamil Al-Amouri, a member of the jihad movement and a former prisoner, and also arrested another operative whom Israel claims it was looking for both.
What happened in Jenin is a new crime. Israel has got crazy after facing resistance by the Palestinians in Al-Quds, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Now it's seeking to show its strength by more killings. It thinks that these killings would prevent the Palestinians from continuing their struggle, but the Palestinians have shown that they won't give in to pressure.
Palestinian factions from across the political spectrum called a general strike in the city to mark the deaths of those killed. Thousands of mourners turned out on the streets in Jenin City to take part in the funeral's procession of the security officers. A third funeral has not been held, as the Israeli forces had arrested the third man before he succumbed to his injuries.
There are orders from the Israeli authorities to accelerate the situation. Netanyahu doesn't want to leave office. He doesn't want to be imprisoned. That's why he wants to make an escalation. But Israel must know that it would pay a high price for its crimes.
The Palestinian presidency has meanwhile condemned the Israeli operation in Jenin, with spokesman Nabil Aburdena holding the Israeli regime responsible for this escalation and its consequences.
Israeli forces have not yet handed over the body of the third Palestinian killed during Jenin raid, Jamil Al-Amouri, a former prisoner and member of the jihad movement. And now Tel Aviv withholds the bodies of 79 Palestinians in its mortuaries, claiming they were killed for operations against Israeli forces. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Salam alaikum.
The June 18th presidential vote draws to a close in Iran, and candidates are on a tight schedule, trying to make the best of the remaining time to attract more public support. In addition to televised campaigns, candidates now visit universities and other key places to increase their popularity among people from different walks of life.
When I make a promise, I'll give you a clear roadmap that shows every step of my plan. For example, if I promise to solve the issue of housing, I will give you the exact timeline of the procedure and the number of houses that I will build for the people who don't have a house.
We try to analyze the current state of affairs in Iran and create plans that are based on real circumstances of our society. We concluded that we could make tangible changes based on our plans.
All of the seven contenders have rich executive backgrounds, from sitting atop the judicial branch to running the Central Bank of Iran. But perhaps their past plays the least part in winning the race, since it's what they plan for the future that matters to voters.
I have a special plans regarding the exchange market. I believe that the capital market plays a significant role in financing the country's industries.
If I took office, I would eliminate the coronavirus once and for all within less than 6 months. I also have comprehensive health policies that would reduce the costs significantly for patients.
We do have plans, but we cannot break them down to their details during a limited time of campaigns. God willing, if I'm elected president, I will operate those plans.
Aside from electoral campaigns, which are mostly held in the form of televised addresses, the candidates face off in live debates. So far, the seven runners have attended two televised debates. The first was themed with economy, and the second centered on social affairs. The third and final showdown is slated for June 12th. Unlike previous rounds where the elections were more of a clash of the parties, this time it's a race of plans. Plans that can ensure a better economy and a brighter future for Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The blame Iran game has been going on for years, but most times it's a ploy used in the Middle East. This time, however, British right-wing newspapers are linking the Islamic Republic to the independence push in Scotland and Wales.
Ever since the very real threat of a potential UK breakup reached the forefront of British politics, stories have begun emerging claiming that Iran-linked social media accounts are spreading fake news online, or that Tehran is somehow building working relations with several anti-Westminster political parties. They've all been doing the rounds. However, are these stories true, and where do they come from?
Political experts in Scotland are far from convinced.
The idea is preposterous. This is desperation. This is a desperate attempt to push back against the momentum that built up in support of Scottish independence. And the ghouls of the British establishment are looking for external bogeymen and scapegoats, when they really should be looking in the mirror to understand why Scottish independence has now gained the firm support of the majority of people living in Scotland. And if anything, it's Britain that interferes in Iranian politics, interferes in the politics of countless countries across the world due to its malign role.
The latest story released by The Telegraph on June the 6th bases its report on work done by UK-based think tank the Henry Jackson Society, whose reputation has been in question many times before.
Henry Jackson Society is well known for its extreme views, extreme right views, extremely pro-Zionist, with bells on, and Islamophobe by its nature. As a matter of fact, is being sort of highlighted by just about every Muslim organization or every other sort of human rights organization as something which was set up to bring extreme right-wing policies into British politics.
Ironically, for British media, the UK's long-standing reputation of meddling in other countries' affairs seems to undermine their attempts to derail the independence train, which has clearly left the station. Robert Carter, London.
Roughly 1 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccines arrived in South Korea from the United States earlier this week. More Americans have been vaccinated than people in any other country, and the U.S. is now sharing, suggesting no strings are attached, with exceptions and flexibility.
The United States is not asking anything of any country to whom we're giving doses. We're not seeking to extract concessions. We're not extorting. Korea's situation is unique. As the president said when President Moon visited, the animating purpose behind that is actually about the protection of American forces and the forces who serve alongside American forces, the Korean troops who are standing shoulder to shoulder with us in that country.
The World Health Organization and infectious disease experts have criticized wealthy countries for hoarding vaccines, vaccine nationalism, even calling it vaccine apartheid. Experts say the U.S. gift to South Korea had various motives. The U.S. has restricted the use of its vaccine supply for South Korea to Korean soldiers that work alongside the 28,500 U.S. troops stationed in the country. U.S. efforts to contain China accelerated back in 2007 with the creation of the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue involving Japan, Australia, India, and the United States. South Korea has been reluctant to join the grouping as it does not want to offend its main trading partner, China, which has condemned the Quad for targeting Beijing. South Korean President Moon Jae-in secured the vaccines during a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden in late May, as Seoul struggles to balance its alliance with the United States and growing trade with China. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, says it's still not clear whether the U.S. is ready to abandon what he calls an addiction to imposing sanctions on Iran. Addressing the IAEA's Board of Governors, Gharibabadi said Iran is in favor of continuing negotiations aimed at reviving the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA, but that it would only go back to full compliance after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions.
The ball is actually in the court of the United States. They have to take very difficult decisions, and political one, of course, whether they are ready to put aside this policy of addiction to the sanctions or not, and whether they are ready to comply their own commitments under the JCPOA and also the other international obligations.
The Iranian envoy said Tehran is also seeking assurances that the U.S. would not withdraw from the deal again or abuse any mechanism within the JCPOA to reimpose sanctions. On Monday, the Board of Governors heard concerns about Iran's past nuclear activities from Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi. Grossi said there was a lack of progress in talks with Iran about the presence of uranium particles found in undeclared locations in the country. Gharibabadi responded by saying the agency is aggrandizing trivial issues that do not pose any proliferation risk and are not urgent. Instead, he argued, the agency should focus on the nuclear weapons program of Israel that's shunned all arms control and non-proliferation treaties.
I recommended the agency to put aside this political approach and not to convert this organization, not to turn this organization into a political organization. The IAEA should remain technical and professional.
As discussions on Iran come to an end at the IAEA, nuclear negotiators are expected to gather at Vienna's Grand Hotel for another round of talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA. Homolesky, Vienna.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.org.